Chapter I: Life and Death of Mrs. Weir. The Lord Justice Clerk was a stranger in that part of the country, but his lady wife was known there from a child, as her race had been before her. The old Riding Rutherfords of Hermiston, of whom she was the last descendant, had been famous men of yore, ill neighbors, ill subjects, and ill husbands to their wives though not their properties. Tales of them were rife for 20 miles about, and their name was even printed in the page of our Scots histories, not always to their credit. One bit the dust at Flodden, one was hanged at his peel door by James V, another fell dead in a carouse with Tom DL, while a fourth, and that was Jean's own father, died presiding at a hellfire club, of which he was the founder. There were many heads shaken in Cross Michael at that judgment, the more so as the man had a villainous reputation among high and low, and both with the godly and the worldly. At that very hour of his demise, he had 10 going pleas before the session, 8 of them oppressive. And the same doom extended even to his agents, his greave, that had been his right hand in many a left-hand business, being cast from his horse one night and drowned in a peat hag on the Kyscares, and his very doer, although lawyers have long spoons, surviving him not long, and dying on a sudden in a bloody flux. In all these generations, while a male Rutherford was in the saddle with his lads, or brawling in a change house, there would be always a white-faced wife immured at home in the old peel or the later mansion house. It seemed this succession of martyrs bided long, but took their vengeance in the end, and that was in the person of the last descendant, Jean. She bore the name of the Rutherfords, but she was the daughter of their trembling wives. At the first she was not wholly without charm. Neighbors recalled in her, as a child, a strain of elfin willfulness, gentle little mutinies, sad little gaieties, even a morning gleam of beauty that was not to be fulfilled. She withered in the growing, and, whether it was the sins of her sires or the sorrows of her mothers, came to her maturity depressed, and, as it were, defaced, no blood of life in her, no grasp or gaiety, pious, anxious, tender, tearful, and incompetent. It was a wonder to many that she had married, seeming so wholly of the stuff that makes old maids. But chance cast her in the path of Adam Weir, then the new Lord Advocate, a recognized, risen man, the conqueror of many obstacles, and thus late in the day beginning to think upon a wife. He was one who looked rather to obedience than beauty, yet it would seem he was struck with her at the first look. "Was she?" he said, turning to his host, and, when he had been told, "Ay," says he, "she looks menseful. She minds me," and then, after a pause, which some have been daring enough to set down to sentimental recollections, "Is she religious?" he asked, and was shortly after, at his own request, presented. The acquaintance, which it seems profane to call a courtship, was pursued with Mr. Weir's accustomed industry, and was long a legend, or rather a source of legends, in the Parliament House. He was described coming, rosy with much port, into the drawing-room, walking direct up to the lady, and assailing her with pleasantries, to which the embarrassed fair one responded, in what seemed a kind of agony, "Ay, Mr. Weir. Or oh, Mr. Weir. Or keep me, Mr. Weir." On the very eve of their engagement, it was related that one had drawn near to the tender couple, and had overheard the lady cry out, with the tones of one who talked for the sake of talking, "Keep me, Mr. Weir," and what became of him. And the profound accents of the suitor reply, "Hunchet, mem, Hunchet." The motives upon either side were much debated. Mr. Weir must have supposed his bride to be somehow suitable, perhaps he belonged to that class of men who think a weak head the ornament of women, an opinion invariably punished in this life. Her descent and her estate were beyond question. Her wayfaring ancestors and her litigious father had done well by Jean. There was ready money and there were broad acres, ready to fall wholly to the husband, to lend dignity to his descendants, and to himself a title, when he should be called upon the bench. On the side of Jean, there was perhaps some fascination of curiosity as to this unknown male animal that approached her with the roughness of a ploughman and the underscore a plum underscore of an advocate. Being so trenchantly opposed to all she knew, loved, or understood, he may well have seemed to her the extreme, if scarcely the ideal, of his sex. And besides, he was an ill man to refuse. A little over 40 at the period of his marriage, he looked already older, and to the force of manhood added the senatorial dignity of years. It was, perhaps, with an unreverent awe, but he was awful. The bench, the bar, and the most experienced and reluctant witness, bowed to his authority, and why not Jeanie Rutherford? The heresy about foolish women is always punished, I have said, and Lord Hermiston began to pay the penalty at once. His house in George Square was wretchedly ill-guided, nothing answerable to the expense of maintenance but the cellar, which was his own private care. When things went wrong at dinner, as they continually did, my lord would look up the table at his wife, "I think these broth would be better to swim in than to sup." Or else to the butler, "Here, m'culup, awa why this radical jigget, tack it to the French, man, and bring me some puddocks. It seems rather a sore kind of a business that I should be all day in court hanging radicals, and get nothing to my dinner." Of course this was but a manner of speaking, and he had never hanged a man for being a radical in his life, the law, of which he was the faithful minister, directing otherwise. And of course these growls were in the nature of pleasantry, but it was of a recondite sort, and uttered as they were in his resounding voice, and commented on by that expression which they called in the Parliament House Hermiston's hanging face, they struck mere dismay into the wife. She sat before him speechless and fluttering, at each dish, as at a fresh ordeal, her eye hovered toward my lord's countenance and fell again, if he but ate in silence, unspeakable relief was her portion, if there were complaint, the world was darkened. She would seek out the cook, who was always her underscore sister in the lord underscore. "Oh, my dear, this is the most dreadful thing that my lord can never be contented in his own house." She would begin, and weep and pray with the cook, and then the cook would pray with Mrs. Weir, and the next day's meal would never be a penny the better, and the next cook, when she came, would be worse, if anything, but just as pious. It was often wondered that Lord Hermiston bore it as he did. Indeed, he was a stoical old voluptuary, contented with sound wine and plenty of it. But there were moments when he overflowed. Perhaps half a dozen times in the history of his married life, "Here, Takigawa, and bring me a piece bread and ketbuck," he had exclaimed, with an appalling explosion of his voice and rare gestures. None thought to dispute or to make excuses, the service was arrested, Mrs. Weir sat at the head of the table whimpering without disguise, and his lordship opposite munched his bread and cheese in ostentatious disregard. Once only, Mrs. Weir had ventured to appeal. He was passing her chair on his way into the study. "Oh, Adam," she wailed, in a voice tragic with tears, and reaching out to him both hands, in one of which she held a sopping pocket handkerchief. He paused and looked upon her with a face of wrath, into which there stole, as he looked, a twinkle of humor. "Nonsense," he said. "You and your nonsense. What do I want with a Christian family? I want Christian broth. Get me a lass that can plain boil a potato, if she was a hurrah the streets." And with these words, which echoed in her tender ears like blasphemy, he had passed on to his study and shut the door behind him. Such was the housewifery in George Square. It was better at Hermiston, where Kirsty Elliot, the sister of a neighboring bonnet laird, and an 18th cousin of the ladies, bore the charge of all, and kept a trim house and a good country table. Kirsty was a woman in a thousand, clean, capable, notable, once a Moorland Helen, and still comely as a blood horse and healthy as the hill wind. High in flesh and voice and color, she ran the house with her whole intemperate soul, in a bustle, not without buffets. Scarce more pious than decency in those days required, she was the cause of many an anxious thought and many a tearful prayer to Mrs. Weir. Housekeeper and mistress renewed the parts of Martha and Mary, and though with a pricking conscience, Mary reposed on Martha's strength as on a rock. Even Lord Hermiston held Kirsty in a particular regard. There were few with whom he unbent so gladly, few whom he favored with so many pleasantries. "Kirsty and me maun have our joke," he would declare in high good humor, as he buttered Kirsty's scones, and she waited at table. A man who had no need either of love or of popularity, a keen reader of men and of events, there was perhaps only one truth for which he was quite unprepared. He would have been quite unprepared to learn that Kirsty hated him. He thought maid and master were well matched, hard, bandy, healthy, broad Scots folk, without a hair of nonsense to the pair of them. And the fact was that she made a goddess and an only child of the effete and tearful lady, and even as she waited at table her hands would sometimes itch for my lord's ears. Thus, at least, when the family were at Hermiston, not only my lord, but Mrs. Weir too, enjoyed a holiday. Free from the dreadful looking for of the miscarried dinner, she would mind her seam, read her piety books, and take her walk, which was my lord's orders, sometimes by herself, sometimes with Archie, the only child of that scarce natural union. The child was her next bond to life. Her frosted sentiment bloomed again, she breathed deep of life, she let loose her heart, in that society. The miracle of her motherhood was ever new to her. The sight of the little man at her skirt intoxicated her with the sense of power, and froze her with the consciousness of her responsibility. She looked forward, and, seeing him in fancy grow up and play his diverse part on the world's theater, caught in her breath and lifted up her courage with a lively effort. It was only with the child that she forgot herself and was at moments natural, yet it was only with the child that she had conceived and managed to pursue a scheme of conduct. Archie was to be a great man and a good, a minister if possible, a saint for certain. She tried to engage his mind upon her favorite books, Rutherford's underscore letters underscore, Scougal's underscore Grace Abounding underscore, and the like. It was a common practice of hers, and strange to remember now, that she would carry the child to the Dales Hags, sit with him on the praying weaver's stone, and talk of the Covenanters till their tears ran down. Her view of history was wholly artless, a design in snow and ink, upon the one side, tender innocents with psalms upon their lips, upon the other, the persecutors, booted, bloody-minded, flushed with wine, a suffering Christ, a raging Beelzebub. Underscore persecutor underscore was a word that knocked upon the woman's heart. It was her highest thought of wickedness, and the mark of it was on her house. Her great-great-grandfather had drawn the sword against the Lord's anointed on the field of Rowland Green, and breathed his last, tradition said, in the arms of the detestable D.L. Nor could she blind herself to this, that had they lived in those old days, Hermiston himself would have been numbered alongside of bloody Mackenzie and the politic Lauderdale and Rothes, in the band of God's immediate enemies. The sense of this moved her to the more fervor. She had a voice for that name of underscore persecutor underscore that thrilled in the child's marrow, and when one day the mob hooted and hissed them all in my lord's traveling carriage, and cried, "Down with the persecutor! Down with hanging Hermiston!" And Mama covered her eyes and wept, and Papa let down the glass and looked out upon the rabble with his droll formidable face, bitter and smiling, as they said he sometimes looked when he gave sentence. Archie was for the moment too much amazed to be alarmed, but he had scarce got his mother by herself before his shrill voice was raised demanding an explanation. Why had they called Papa a persecutor? "Keep me, my precious," she exclaimed. "Keep me, my dear. This is political. Ye must never ask me anything political, Erky. Your faither is a great man, my dear, and it's no for me or you to be judging him. It would be telling us all, if we behaved ourselves in our several stations the way your faither does in his high office, and let me hear no more of any such disrespectful and undutiful questions. Know that you meant to be undutiful, my lamb, your mother kens that, she kens it well, dearie." And so slid off to safer topics, and left on the mind of the child an obscure but ineradicable sense of something wrong. Mrs. Ware's philosophy of life was summed in one expression, tenderness. In her view of the universe, which was all lighted up with a glow out of the doors of hell, good people must walk there in a kind of ecstasy of tenderness. The beasts and plants had no souls, they were here but for a day, and let their day pass gently. And as for the immortal men, on what black, downward path were many of them wending, and to what a horror of an immortality! Are not two sparrows, whosoever shall smite thee, God sendeth his rain, judge not, that ye be not judged. These texts made her body of divinity. She put them on in the morning with her clothes and lay down to sleep with them at night. They haunted her like a favorite air, they clung about her like a favorite perfume. Their minister was a marrowy expounder of the law, and my lord sat under him with relish, but Mrs. Ware respected him from far off, heard him, like the cannon of a beleaguered city, usefully booming outside on the dogmatic ramparts, and meanwhile, within and out of shot, dwelt in her private garden which she watered with grateful tears. It seems strange to say of this colorless and ineffectual woman, but she was a true enthusiast, and might have made the sunshine and the glory of a cloister. Perhaps none but Archie knew she could be eloquent, perhaps none but he had seen her, her color raised, her hands clasped or quivering, glow with gentle ardor. There is a corner of the policy of Hermiston, where you come suddenly in view of the summit of Black Fell, sometimes like the mere grass top of a hill, sometimes, and this is her own expression, like a precious jewel in the heavens. On such days, upon the sudden view of it, her hand would tighten on the child's fingers, her voice rise like a song. Underscore I to the hills underscore. She would repeat. And oh, Erky, are nay these like the hills of Naphtali? And her tears would flow. Upon an impressionable child the effect of this continual and pretty accompaniment to life was deep. The woman's quietism and piety passed on to his different nature undiminished, but whereas in her it was a native sentiment, in him it was only an implanted dogma. Nature and the child's pugnacity at times revolted. A cad from the Potter Row once struck him in the mouth, he struck back, the pair fought it out in the back stable lane towards the meadows, and Archie returned with a considerable decline in the number of his front teeth, and unregenerately boasting of the losses of the foe. It was a sore day for Mrs. Ware. She wept and prayed over the infant backslider until my lord was due from court, and she must resume that air of tremulous composure with which he always greeted him. The judge was that day in an observant mood, and remarked upon the absent teeth. "I am afraid Erky will have been feeding with some of the blackyard lads," said Mrs. Weir. My lord's voice rang out as it did seldom in the privacy of his own house. "I'll have norm of that, sir," he cried. "Do you hear me? None of that. No son of mine shall be speltering in the glore with any dirty rabble." The anxious mother was grateful for so much support, she had even feared the contrary. And that night when she put the child to bed, "Now, my dear, ye see," she said, "I told you what your faither would think of it, if he heard ye had fallen into this dreadful sin, and let you and me pray to God that ye may be keepeth from the like temptation or strengthened to resist it." The womanly falsity of this was thrown away. Ice and iron cannot be welded, and the points of view of the justice clerk and Mrs. Weir were not less unassimilable. The character and position of his father had long been a stumbling block to Archie, and with every year of his age the difficulty grew more instant. The man was mostly silent, when he spoke at all, it was to speak of the things of the world, always in a worldly spirit, often in language that the child had been schooled to think coarse, and sometimes with words that he knew to be sins in themselves. Tenderness was the first duty, and my lord was invariably harsh. God was love, the name of my lord, to all who knew him, was fear. In the world, as schematized for Archie by his mother, the place was marked for such a creature. There were some whom it was good to pity and well, though very likely useless, to pray for. They were named reprobates, goats, God's enemies, brands for the burning, and Archie tallied every mark of identification, and drew the inevitable private inference that the Lord Justice Clerk was the chief of sinners. The mother's honesty was scarce complete. There was one influence she feared for the child and still secretly combated, that was my lord's, and half unconsciously, half in a willful blindness, she continued to undermine her husband with his son. As long as Archie remained silent, she did so ruthlessly, with a single eye to heaven and the child's salvation, but the day came when Archie spoke. It was 1801, and Archie was 7, and beyond his years for curiosity and logic, when he brought the case up openly. If judging were sinful and forbidden, how came Papa to be a judge? To have that sin for a trade? To bear the name of it for a distinction? "I can't see it," said the little rabbi, and wagged his head. Mrs. Weir abounded in commonplace replies. "No, I can't see it," reiterated Archie. "And I'll tell you what, Mama, I don't think you and me's justified in staying with him." The woman awoke to remorse, she saw herself disloyal to her man, her sovereign and breadwinner, in whom, with what she had of worldliness, she took a certain subdued pride. She expatiated in reply on my lord's honor and greatness, his useful services in this world of sorrow and wrong, and the place in which he stood, far above where babes in innocence could hope to see or criticize. But she had builded too well, Archie had his answers pat. Were not babes and innocents the type of the kingdom of heaven? Were not honor and greatness the badges of the world? And at any rate, how about the mob that had once seethed about the carriage? "It's all very fine," he concluded, "but in my opinion Papa has no right to be it. And it seems that's not the worst yet of it. It seems he's called the hanging judge, it seems he's cruel. I'll tell you what it is, Mama, there's a text borne in upon me. It were better for that man if a milestone were bound upon his back and him flung into the deepest most parts of the sea." "Oh, my lamb, ye must never say the like of that," she cried. "Ye're to honor faither and mother, dear, that your days may be long in the land. It's atheists that cry out against him, French atheists, Erky. Ye would never surely even yourself down to be saying the same thing as French atheists? It would break my heart to think that of you. And oh, Erky, here arena underscore you underscore setting up to underscore judge underscore? And have ye no forgot God's plain command, the first with promise, dear? Mind you upon the beam and the moat." Having thus carried the war into the enemy's camp, the terrified lady breathed again. And no doubt it is easy thus to circumvent a child with catchwords, but it may be questioned how far it is effectual. An instinct in his breast detects the quibble, and a voice condemns it. He will instantly submit, privately hold the same opinion. For even in this simple and antique relation of the mother and the child, hypocrisies are multiplied. When the court rose that year and the family returned to Hermiston, it was a common remark in all the country that the lady was sore failed. She seemed to lose and seize again her touch with life, now sitting inert in a sort of durable bewilderment, anon waking to feverish and weak activity. She dawdled about the lasses at their work, looking stupidly on, she fell to rummaging in old cabinets and presses, and desisted when half through. She would begin remarks with an air of animation and drop them without a struggle. Her common appearance was of one who has forgotten something and is trying to remember, and when she overhauled, one after another, the worthless and touching mementos of her youth, she might have been seeking the clue to that lost thought. During this period, she gave many gifts to the neighbors and house lasses, giving them with a manner of regret that embarrassed the recipients. The last night of all, she was busy on some female work, and toiled upon it with so manifest and painful a devotion that my lord, who was not often curious, inquired as to its nature. She blushed to the eyes. "Oh, Edom, it's for you," she said. "It's slippers. I hae never made ye any." "Ye daft auld wife," returned his lordship. "A bonny figure I would be, pummering about in botchles." The next day, at the hour of her walk, Kirsty interfered. Kirsty took this decay of her mistress very hard, bore her a grudge, quarreled with and railed upon her, the anxiety of a genuine love wearing the disguise of temper. This day of all days she insisted disrespectfully, with rustic fury, that Mrs. Weir should stay at home. But, "No, no," she said, "it's my lord's orders," and set forth as usual. Archie was visible in the acre bog, engaged upon some childish enterprise, the instrument of which was mire, and she stood and looked at him a while like one about to call, then thought otherwise, sighed, and shook her head, and proceeded on her rounds alone. The house lasses were at the burnside washing, and saw her pass with her loose, weary, dowdy gait. "She's a terrible feckless wife, the mistress," said the one. "Tut," said the other, "the woman say eck." "Weel, I canna see nae differ in her," returned the first. "A fushionless queen, a feckless carline." The poor creature thus discussed rambled a while in the grounds without a purpose. Tides in her mind ebbed and flowed, and carried her to and fro like seaweed. She tried a path, paused, returned, and tried another, questing, forgetting her quest, the spirit of choice extinct in her bosom, or devoid of sequency. On a sudden, it appeared as though she had remembered, or had formed a resolution, wheeled about, returned with hurried steps, and appeared in the dining room, where Kirsty was at the cleaning, like one charged with an important errand. "Kirsty," she began, and paused, and then with conviction, "Mr. Weir isn't spiritually minded, but he has been a good man to me." It was perhaps the first time since her husband's elevation that she had forgotten the handle to his name, of which the tender, inconsistent woman was not a little proud. And when Kirsty looked up at the speaker's face, she was aware of a change. "God's sake, what's the matter wi' ye, ma'am?" cried the housekeeper, starting from the rug. "I do not ken," answered her mistress, shaking her head. "But he is not spiritually minded, my dear. Here, sit down with ye." "God's sake, what ails the wife?" cried Kirsty, and helped and forced her into my lord's own chair by the cheek of the hearth. "Keep me, what's this?" she gasped. "Kirsty, what's this? I'm frightened." They were her last words. It was the lowering nightfall when my lord returned. He had the sunset in his back, all clouds and glory, and before him, by the wayside, spied Kirsty Elliot waiting. She was dissolved in tears, and addressed him in the high, false note of barbarous mourning, such as still lingers modified among Scots heather. "The Lord pity ye, Hermiston. The Lord prepare ye," she keened out. "Weary upon me, that I should have to tell it." He reined in his horse and looked upon her with a hanging face. "Has the French landed?" cried he. "Man, man," she said, "is that a ye can think of? The Lord prepare ye, the Lord comfort and support ye." "Is onybody dead?" said his lordship. "It's no Erky?" "Beth and Kit, no," exclaimed the woman, startled into a more natural tone. "Nah, nah, it's no say bad as that. It's the mistress, my lord, she just fear flitted before my een. She just geet a sabin was by Wyatt. Eh, my bonny Miss Jeanie, that I mind say weel." And forth again upon that pouring tide of lamentation in which women of her class excel in overabound. Lord Hermiston sat in the saddle beholding her. Then he seemed to recover command upon himself. "Well, it's something of the suddenest," said he. "But she was a dwabbly body from the first." And he rode home at a precipitate amble with Kirsty at his horse's heels. Dressed as she was for her last walk, they had laid the dead lady on her bed. She was never interesting in life, in death she was not impressive, and as her husband stood before her, with his hands crossed behind his powerful back, that which he looked upon was the very image of the insignificant. "Her and me were never cut out for one another," he remarked at last. "It was a daft-like marriage." And then, with the most unusual gentleness of tone, "Pure bitch," said he, "pure bitch." Then suddenly, "Where's Erky?" Kirsty had decoyed him to her room and given him a jelly piece. "Ye have some kind of gumption, too," observed the judge, and considered his housekeeper grimly. When all's said, he added, "I might have done war, I might have been married upon a skirting Jezebel like you." "There's nobody thinking of you, Hermiston," cried the offended woman. "We think of her that's out of her sorrows. And could she have done war? Tell me that, Hermiston, tell me that before her clay called core." "Weel, there's some of them gay and ill to please," observed his lordship. Chapter 2 Father and Son. My Lord Justice Clerk was known to many, the man Adam Weir perhaps to none. He had nothing to explain or to conceal, he sufficed wholly and silently to himself, and that part of our nature which goes out, too often with false coin, to acquire glory or love, seemed in him to be omitted. He did not try to be loved, he did not care to be, it is probable the very thought of it was a stranger to his mind. He was an admired lawyer, a highly unpopular judge, and he looked down upon those who were his inferiors in either distinction, who were lawyers of less grasp or judges not so much detested. In all the rest of his days and doings, not one trace of vanity appeared, and he went on through life with a mechanical movement, as of the unconscious, that was almost august. He saw little of his son. In the childish maladies with which the boy was troubled, he would make daily inquiries and daily pay him a visit, entering the sick room with a facetious and appalling countenance, letting off a few perfunctory jests, and going again swiftly, to the patient's relief. Once, a court holiday falling opportunely, my lord had his carriage, and drove the child himself to Hermiston, the customary place of convalescence. It is conceivable he had been more than usually anxious, for that journey always remained in Archie's memory as a thing apart, his father having related to him from beginning to end, and with much detail, three authentic murder cases. Archie went the usual round of other Edinburgh boys, the high school and the college, and Hermiston looked on, or rather looked away, with scarce an affectation of interest in his progress. Daily, indeed, upon a signal after dinner, he was brought in, given nuts and a glass of port, regarded sardonically, sarcastically questioned. "Well, sir, and what have you done with your book today?" My lord might begin, and set him posers in law Latin. To a child just stumbling into Quadrius, Papinian and Paul proved quite invincible. But Papa had memory of no other. He was not harsh to the little scholar, having a vast fund of patience learned upon the bench, and was at no pains whether to conceal or to express his disappointment. "Well, you have a long jaunt before ye yet," he might observe, yawning, and fall back on his own thoughts, as like as not, until the time came for separation, and my lord would take the decanter and the glass, and be off to the back chamber looking on the meadows, where he toiled on his cases till the hours were small. There was no fuller man on the bench, his memory was marvelous, though wholly legal, if he had to advise extempore, none did it better, yet there was none who more earnestly prepared. As he thus watched in the night, or sat at table and forgot the presence of his son, no doubt but he tasted deeply of recondite pleasures. To be wholly devoted to some intellectual exercise is to have succeeded in life, and perhaps only in law and the higher mathematics may this devotion be maintained, suffice to itself without reaction, and find continual rewards without excitement. This atmosphere of his father's sterling industry was the best of Archie's education. Assuredly it did not attract him, assuredly it rather rebutted and depressed. Yet it was still present, unobserved like the ticking of a clock, an arid ideal, a tasteless stimulant in the boy's life. But Hermiston was not all of one piece. He was, besides, a mighty toper, he could sit at wine until the day dawned, and pass directly from the table to the bench with a steady hand and a clear head. Beyond the third bottle, he showed the plebeian in a larger print, the low, gross accent, the low, foul mirth, grew broader and commoner, he became less formidable, and infinitely more disgusting. Now, the boy had inherited from Jean Rutherford a shivering delicacy, unequally mated with potential violence. In the playing fields, and amongst his own companions, he repaid a coarse expression with a blow. At his father's table, when the time came for him to join these revels, he turned pale and sickened in silence. Of all the guests whom he there encountered, he had toleration for only one, David Keith Carnegie, Lord Glenalmond. Lord Glenalmond was tall and emaciated, with long features and long delicate hands. He was often compared with the statue of Forbes of Culloden in the Parliament House, and his blue eye, at more than 60, preserved some of the fire of youth. His exquisite disparity with any of his fellow guests, His appearance as of an artist and an aristocrat stranded in rude company, riveted the boy's attention, and his curiosity and interest are the things in the world that are the most immediately and certainly rewarded. Lord Glenalmond was attracted by the boy. "And so this is your son, Hermiston?" he asked, laying his hand on Archie's shoulder. "He's getting a big lad." "Hout," said the gracious father, just his mother over again, "Dorna say boo to a goose." But the stranger retained the boy, talked to him, drew him out, found in him a taste for letters, and a fine, ardent, modest, youthful soul, and encouraged him to be a visitor on Sunday evenings in his bare, cold, lonely dining room, where he sat and read in the isolation of a bachelor grown old in refinement. The beautiful gentleness and grace of the old judge, and the delicacy of his person, thoughts, and language, spoke to Archie's heart in its own tongue. He conceived the ambition to be such another, and, when the day came for him to choose a profession, it was in emulation of Lord Glenalmond, not of Lord Hermiston, that he chose the bar. Hermiston looked on at this friendship with some secret pride, but openly with the intolerance of scorn. He scarce lost an opportunity to put them down with a rough jape, and, to say truth, it was not difficult, for they were neither of them quick. He had a word of contempt for the whole crowd of poets, painters, fiddlers, and their admirers, the bastard race of amateurs, which was continually on his lips. "Signor Fiddleri," he would say. "Oh, for God's sake, no more of the signor." "You and my father are great friends, are you not?" asked Archie once. "There is no man that I more respect, Archie," replied Lord Glenalmond. "He is two things of price. He is a great lawyer, and he is upright as the day." "You and he are so different," said the boy, his eyes dwelling on those of his old friend, like a lover's on his mistress's.
"Indeed so," replied the judge, "very different. And so I fear are you and he. Yet I would like it very ill if my young friend were to misjudge his father. He has all the Roman virtues, Cato and Brutus were such, I think a son's heart might well be proud of such an ancestry of one."
"And I would sooner he were a platted herd," cried Archie, with sudden bitterness.
"And that is neither very wise, nor I believe entirely true," returned Glenalmond. "Before you are done you will find some of these expressions rise on you like a remorse. They are merely literary and decorative, they do not aptly express your thought, nor is your thought clearly apprehended, and no doubt your father, if he were here, would say, 'Signor Fiddleri.'" With the infinitely delicate sense of youth, Archie avoided the subject from that hour. It was perhaps a pity. Had he but talked freely, let himself gush out in words, the way youth loves to do and should, there might have been no tale to write upon the wares of Hermiston. But the shadow of a threat of ridicule sufficed. In the slight tartness of these words he read a prohibition, and it is likely that Glenalmond meant it so. Besides the veteran, the boy was without confidant or friend. Serious and eager, he came through school and college, and moved among a crowd of the indifferent, in the seclusion of his shyness. He grew up handsome, with an open, speaking countenance, with graceful, youthful ways, he was clever, he took prizes, he shone in the speculative society. It should seem he